Why are people even attracted? Like, why are they so obsessed with Baby Yoda?
When 900 years old you reach, look as good you are not.
It, for me, it's pretty obvious that there is a parallel between Baby Yoda and Baby Jesus, in a way. And there is such a response to Baby Yoda by our so-called Christian North American culture. And I was like, huh, I wonder how many people have taken the time to contemplate Jesus in the same way. How come we don't have that same response to the Lord now? Especially this Christmas season. When if you stop to think about it, the things that draw us to Baby Yoda are in many ways the things that he shares with Baby Jesus. So I just wanted to look into that more and see, you know, what sort of parallels are there? What sort of influence has there been of Hebraic thought, of the Christmas story, of Christian thought that we can see in what's up with Baby Yoda. And Baby Yoda himself also draws, you know, from sort of, what would you call it? Sort of the inheritance of, or the legacy of Yoda, even though he's not even Yoda. And we don't know where he's from or who he's from. I mean, is it Yoda's kid, right? Is it Yoda's, like, nephew?
Right.
Is it Yoda's anything? It might not be.
The Star Wars Holiday Special.
We just know
that it's an intentionally ambiguous species within the Star Wars universe.
Right, right. Of intentionally ambiguous parentage or origin.
Right. With an intentionally Jewish name, a Hebrew name.
That is true. Or Yoda is.
Yeah, Yoda.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a question whether Yoda is actually his name or it's his, like, the name of his species. Whether these are Yodas. Or whether he is Yoda.
You know why I think... you mean Yoda? Now you're talking about Yoda.
Yoda himself. Well, as far as I know, this goes back to the...
Okay. The species has got to be something other than Yoda, right? Because there's a Yaddle.
What's a Yaddle?
Well, Yaddle is the female... she's like in one of, like, she's in one of the earlier episodes.
You mean one of the fake episodes, the ones that came out exactly. After the 80s ones. Yeah.
So there's a Yaddle. She's like an elderly female of the same species as Yoda.
Okay, so these are sexed creatures then.
Apparently so, but you know, who knows how many kinds of gender they have.
That's true.
I mean, Yaddle we think is apparently female and Yoda we think is apparently male. I don't know how they reproduce. I don't, you know, and who knows? I mean, we don't know what the birth narrative exactly is of Baby Yoda, right. Baby so-called Yoda.
I met him in a swamp down in Dagobah where it bubbles all the time like a giant carbonated soda. S-O-D-A soda. I saw the little runt sitting there on a log. Him his name and in a raspy voice he said Yoda. Y-O-D-A Yoda. Yo 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 Yoda. Laughing around but I ain't ever seen a guy who looks like a Muppet but he's wrinkled and green. Oh my Yoda. Yo 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 Yoda.
That's the effect of narrative, right? And that is, it's because we asked the question of why is there so much narrative in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament? And, you know, what is it about narrative? Why isn't there more history? Why isn't there more wisdom? Why isn't there more prophetic text? What is it about narrative? And the thing about narrative...
Or more just straight talk. This is what people often say when we discuss, like, well, here's how the biblical authors talk about abstract concepts. And people will often say, well, why don't they just say what they mean? And I'm like, well, why do you think narrative is not saying what you mean, or a better way to describe it, right? So same question.
Right, right. So, and so what is it that narrative does? Narrative invites us into the story. Narrative is actually what unites the people. It's what gives people the identity. It's not any particular codex so much as having the shared history, having the shared narrative.
What do you mean by codex?
Or is it just like, or any code? Okay.
I was like a book? If you describe, I think there's two things going on here. One, it's not an accident that this Mandalorian, this baby, whatever, Yoda, came out right in the build up to the Christmas buying season.
And yet, you can't get the toys. Until May.
Oh. So maybe they didn't plan it. Maybe they didn't realize this was going to be this big of a success.
Well, or no. Or did they know?
Build the demand, yeah.
Yeah. But did they know that people would make parallels between that and the Christmas story? Because it's obviously not
They're
from the money.
Us.
There's articles. There's a lot of articles out about how much money Disney has lost by not by trying to keep it such a secret. That even the toy makers didn't know that Baby Yoda existed, so to speak, in the narrative world.
So there's these parallels between obviously the Christmas story and this Yoda story.
Some people think some people think the timing of the Mandalorian might have something to do with something with Star Wars film number 9 coming out.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it is. Set up for it.
You think so?
But then there's the other
See,
part.
I'm not sure I'm convinced of that.
Well,
enthusiasm, but in terms of plot or characters, I'd be really surprised if we see anyone in The Mandalorian in episode 9.
I mean, I will now offend everybody who's a Star Wars fan like I am from birth. I saw Empire Strikes Back in the theater, right? I'm just old enough to where I couldn't see the original one in the theater, but I will say, you know, they basically gave up on plot and acting in the first movies. I mean, there's never been, I mean, including Natalie Portman ones. I mean, there's never been a deep desire to have fantastic plots and wonderful acting in these movies, right? So I don't think we need to fight that battle. Like, or is that what they're going for? But I think the draw of Baby Yoda above all other things is the social media draw, which is you can post a picture of him, the eyes to skull ratio, the symmetry, like the dress, everything, is it tugs on our sense of the innocent child, right? And so, you know, there's this thing with the ratio of, with all animals, like, why do we think little animals are cute? It's mostly just because the size of the eyes to the rest of the head is essentially what makes the cuteness factor go up. And so, yeah.
I'm looking at my dog right now. I think so, Mickey. Yes, you have just the perfect ratio, don't you?
And so, yeah, there's this sense that he's visually cute in this really innocent way. And even when he floats around in a floating bassinet just following this bounty hunter through the most dangerous places in the universe in the story, right?
Right, you have that juxtaposition of, like, you know, this, like, tough guy, tough, rough Mandalorian who doesn't even have a face. And then you have Baby Yoda, who is pretty much nothing but face.
Right. He's nothing but face, and he's the cutest thing in the world, and he's this baby who seemingly needs to be protected. And then, as we all knew, or we suspected from the other Star Wars movies, he's more powerful than everybody else on the planet. Whatever planet he's on, he's more powerful than everybody else on that planet.
Right. So it's not just the fact that he's cute and a baby, because we do have babies that already appear in the Star Wars universe. I really think it is in part the inner Star Wars allusions to everything that we know about Yoda that contributes to the appeal of this particular child. If he was just, you know, because you could probably do the same thing. There was like this one baby Wookiee. Did you see the baby Wookiee?
No,
it was a baby. No, I'm sorry. I think it was a baby Ewok. It was cute.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That makes more sense. Yeah. Ewoks themselves are cute.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, he didn't have the effect of, like, Baby Yoda.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
And Leia and Luke as infants in the fake Star Wars movies.
Yeah. No, we didn't care. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But they were actually babies.
Been there, done that. Yeah.
So there is something about Yoda, baby Yoda, that is not simply the fact that he's cute. There's a lot of, I think, you know, there's a lot of narratival shorthand happening with the fact that he's evidently from the same species as Yoda. So the whole backstory of Yoda, the audience can't help but, import that into what's happening here.
So this is what we discussed in the first Christmas Advent episode of Endangered Babies for the podcast, where I was pushing the case that, you know, Yoda to this baby, whatever it is, whatever the name is, it's going to acquire over time here, is kind of Moses to Jesus relation in the biblical narrative. That you already have this massive storyline that's already been played, an endangered baby who was hunted down by King. All the parallels are there, set up for you to see them. Interestingly, though, I don't think most Christians think of the Moses story as kind of a proto-Christmas narrative. I don't think actually most Christians ever make the connection between those two stories, unless a pastor makes it for them in, you know, a Christmas Eve sermon or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you're right that that Baby Yoda has all the cachet of both cuteness in this massive meta narrative sitting right under everything he does, so that every move he makes, you're like, oh, that's so Yoda. We're just waiting to see whether he fulfills the mold that's already been made out for him in our minds, or whether he's going to violate some expectations in some way, right?
Right, right. So kind of playing into that type scene that's set up by Star Wars. But at the same time, we have him, he enters with a type scene that is reminiscent of the Christmas story. And so...
Okay, let's stop. Let me stop you there. Explain very quickly what you mean when you say type scene, and then we'll talk about the type scene of the Christmas story.
All right, so when I say type scene, I mean, I'm speaking actually as a Hebrew Bible Old Testament narratologist. So
you're using it in the way that Robert Alter or Meir Sternberger, one of these guys.
Exactly. Those are the two books think of to direct anyone to start with if they want to get into this stuff. Yeah. One for philosophy and the other one for just simple pragmatics of what this looks like.
Yeah.
So what do I think? I think of it as I think of it as a literary convention of presenting a set of circumstances and plot points to the audience where they are set up to have certain expectations. Mm-hmm. So the appeal of a type scene is that it steps into a pattern that the audience is expected to recognize. And so they can kind of track with what's going on.
It's like a narratival etiquette or something, right?
I guess so. Yeah. In terms of
greases the gears of the interaction so that you kind of know what to expect at various points. And
right. So you have a plot where you have a big bad baddie and someone who's the goodie. You expect that there's going to be a conflict. You expect there's going to be a resolution. You expect that.
Okay, the fact that you said baddie and goodie tells me you lived in the UK for some part of your life, because it's the only place I've ever heard those terms being used.
I am a multicultural person. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. The only place I've heard people, kids play cops and baddies rather than cops and robbers. And so we could talk about type scenes even as kind of a more specific version of a genre, where a genre, like, so The Mandalorian, the genre is kind of almost a spaghetti western. But the type scenes here are more like these infant exposure motifs, the infant in danger. And which begs the question of the power of the infant. Why would anybody hunt down this 50-year-old baby? That's another. We should probably put a spoiler alert bumper on the front of this.
I was thinking the same thing. Actually, I forgot to mention that. there's another one too. The bounty hunter, who finds out more about his target.
Yeah. Right. Falls in love with his target, as it were.
Yeah, and then. Yeah. The moral conflict that comes from that and how that gets resolved.
Okay, so you were saying the Christmas type scene is kind of being, invoked here in parts of The Mandalorian.
I think so, both by nature of the plot, but also by the timing of when The Mandalorian came up. And the fact that, I mean, I don't want to guess too much, you know, why Disney did what they did. I know that, I think he was the director or the executive producer who had the...
Jon Favreau?
Was he the one who made the request to Disney to keep it a secret? Keep Yoda, baby Yoda.
I don't know. He's the one who's made all of these. He's okay. In charge.
So I think he's the one who asked Disney to keep it a secret. He didn't think they were going to do it, but they honored that. Hmm. Now, why, I don't know. But he was actually pleasantly pleased too, from what I've seen in the interview and stuff. But without having the merchandise and all that other stuff, it keeps the focus on the story. Hmm. And I don't know, I can't help but wonder, you know, again, the timing of when The Mandalorian came out. In a way, we can't be distracted by all the merchandise. We just have to focus on what's happening there. I mean, there is one thing you can buy. You can buy a Disney Plus like subscription.
Right. Well, which is exactly what the one action Disney wanted consumers to make in this last month is to buy a subscription to Disney Plus.
Worked.
Like, yeah. Yeah, no, we all got it, right? Yeah, so what you're saying is not only is there a generic priming of the Christmas story that ties to this, what's going on in the storyline of The Mandalorian, but you're saying there's already a cultural priming because of the Christmas season.
Yeah, how they set it up.
That doubly primed us.
It's context is everything. Context is everything. So
I might have said that once or twice in a hermeneutics class.
Christmas time is drawing near. Let's all spread some cheer. Grab your wallet, time to spend. Most wonderful time of year. Hiding presents in your closet, hoping that they won't find out. Season's greetings, obligation.
This is not the kind of stuff that biblical scholars normally think of. We've got quite a few levels happening.
Or you can't help but see it everywhere. It makes you wonder if... how in tune they are with this, how much we as a culture are being primed. I mean, because what you're suggesting is there's a marketing department that is thinking very carefully about cultural moments and where to while the iron's hot.
They could have made billions of dollars from the things I've been reading. They could have made billions of dollars off of merchandise, off of Baby Yoda merchandise this Christmas. That's what everyone would have expected. They knew what they were doing and not doing that and holding off till May or whatever.
Interesting.
You're gonna hold off on that Baby Yoda toy, aren't you?
I will probably not purchase. The last Star Wars paraphernalia I purchased, I think, was in 1989, somewhere. No, 1986, probably around then.
And that was before you guys had four kids.
As far as I know. Okay, so if that's the case, then... There's another part of the kind of the cultural moment in which the story injects itself that we both ran across the same interview with Anthony Daniels, the C-3PO actor, where he says he's got a concern that the Yoda character is going to get lost in the shuffle, as it were, because of all the cuteness and the Christmas story. So he seems to be noticing the same thing. I'm just going to quote him a little bit here. He says, Baby Yoda, it had to happen. It had to happen just before Christmas. Baby Yoda is the thing, maybe the toy of the month, the year, or whatever. And then he goes on to say, Baby Yoda is cute and gorgeous, but I'd warn the public that Baby Yoda is not just for Christmas. It's a responsibility. And of course, to me, this is hilarious because this is how Christians talk about, you know, Jesus is the reason for the seat. You know, don't lose Jesus. And don't lose the Christmas story, and don't lose the idea that God intervened on behalf of the cosmos through His Son all the consumerism. And now you have a guy who's involved in entertainment saying, "Don't lose this precious character just because it's gotten wrapped up with Christmas." So, like, Christmas has become the black hole that sucks everything in and spits it out empty, lifeless and lightless, I guess. So he seems to be worried about this culture. He seems to see the stars aligning, no pun intended, on this the release of the series with this cultural moment in the West. So the question is, you're of Chinese descent, right?
I am, but you know, I'm third generation, so I feel like I'm more.
Yeah, Northern so you're worthless here on cultural questions.
I'm a Northern California culture. I'm from the Northern California culture.
Yeah.
You know, so I can inform you on that. There's some Asian
I'm
things.
Of Irish descent, and I have the same relationship with anything an Irish person would feel about something today. But I mean, it would be interesting to think about something like Indian culture, how this lands in Indian culture or Chinese culture or Mongolian culture, African culture. Someone who's not primed necessarily by the Christmas story, if it has the same effect in that culture. Of course, Disney is not trying to sell Disney Plus subscriptions to those markets either.
Well, so. Some of them they are, actually. I saw an article on that. But anyway, it's more like the Star Wars movies that they're trying to target to other places.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, we talked earlier about Miki Karasimbi here. And how he is—he comes from a very strong Tibetan root. And people in public see him, and they're like, "Oh, he's the cutest thing!" And everybody wants to pet him, and I have to warn them that he's a service dog. And he responds to stimuli a little differently than most people. But he's a long way from home. And how people respond to him here in California, which is, you know, the cute cuddle ball, the little snowball kind of thing, is different than how people would respond to him now in Lhasa. How do I know? Well, because soon after we got him, I thought, oh, he's just the cutest thing. I wonder what it's like to be in the town where they have all these Lhasa Apso's, you know. So I looked it up, you know, Lhasa Apso's, Tibet, what's going on today? There are so many Lhasa Apso's, or there were so many Lhasa Apso's in Lhasa, that they're almost like feral cats. There are feral dogs, if you can believe it. And and so what the government did was they started systematically killing them. Just destroying them. I mean, people would protest if they knew that it was happening over here. I mean, these things, if you actually, ours was a rescue dog, but otherwise these things are worth like hundreds of dollars. And over there, you know, it's just been like a massacre. Because there are too many, so many of them, you know. So,
and Merry Christmas, everybody who's listening.
As long as you're talking about massacre, right? You know, people hate. They were trying to kill off. Hey, some the big bad baddie was trying to kill off Baby Yoda, right?
Yeah,
Herod had somebody turn
this down to Bethlehem. Yeah, okay.
All right, there we go. Right, Mandalorian. He's just like the Magi. There we go.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggedy tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale.
We should also mention here that that most people will not be aware that Yoda is one of the few Hebraicisms. There are a few others in the Star Wars universe, but it's one of the clear Hebraicisms from the verb yada, to know, which Yodea, I asked some Israeli friends of mine who are biblical scholars, I was like, can you work this out? And they were like, well, it's not really a word. It's not a participle. It doesn't really do anything. You know, the closest you get in Israeli Hebrew is you say, lo yodea, I don't know, right? Lo yodea. But it's something like he's the knower or the knowing one or the knowish thing. So he's already got this loosely Hebraic tie, which shouldn't surprise us with George Lucas.
Well, but with ancient Hebrew, though, that's a participial form, isn't it?
I'm trying to think if you find it in biblical Hebrew anywhere.
Well, we must.
I'd have to look it up.
I mean, you can't see the breathing mark when you say Yoda, you know, nowadays.
That's true.
But, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an iteration of it somewhere. I'm sure that iteration is not what George Lucas was going after in his, you know, in his Talmud studies. Maybe it's an Aramaicism, actually. I don't know.
I think he was intentional. I think he was very intentional on that, on Yoda coming from Yoda.
Yeah, I think that one is obvious. Exactly what he meant to do with it, other than just saying, this is the dude who knows, right? Which is the role he plays. He seems to, like, see through everything, see through people's hearts, intentions, see the massive, the meta-narrative that's going on in the galaxy, even though he lives out in the middle of a swamp. Yeah.
It's like the perfect, okay. It's a perfect word, because it's not really... it's not just the English sense of to know. It's not just about information, but right. the Hebraic, the ancient Hebraic sense, at least, is very, you know, you have a relationship with something if you really know something, and that could include inanimate objects, which the Force, in contrast to Yahweh, is the Force is impersonal. So, but mm-hmm. Yadah would allow that you could have that kind of relationship with something impersonal to actually yeah. know it.
Also, but it does include in the range of meaning there is to have sex with somebody or something.
Right, which is possible. Both. Maybe he did it, and that's how we got Baby Yoda, you know?
Both procreational sex and sexual, you know, non-procreational sex, to put it politely, I guess.
So that's really being in relationship with something.
It is, and this is, I mean, there's this question, because it's only about 4 or 6 instances in the Hebrew Bible where to know something is to have sex with it, or to intend to have sex, like in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Oh, wow, so is it almost all in Genesis?
Yeah, I think so. Most of them are Genesis, but not all, if I remember correctly. But Michael Karasik has a great little line on it. He says, whatever this word means in its fullness, there's some sense of coming closer to. So karev, to be near, might be a good paired connotative range mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. that it brings you near to something.
So there's his name. There's the way he speaks. Now, I thought at first,
he fronts. He does fronting.
Oh, you saw? Yeah. That's a thing. Yeah. Did I tell you that one?
Okay. No. But explain what we mean by fronting.
So frontal element. If you were to take a sentence and you were to take the part of the sentence that you want to emphasize. Something that we do a lot, at least in ancient Hebrew, is to put that element at the beginning of the sentence.
Like the very first thing in the sentence.
Right. So you're going to hear some pages turn here. Do you have, offhand, Drew, do you have an example of that from the Hebrew Bible?
I was just reading one the other day in Deuteronomy 4, where you expect a vayik tol verb at the front, but what was fronted instead? You expect a verb. It was Adonai Elohim or Elohenu. That was fronted instead of the vayik tol verb, which so the regular perfect form of the verb came afterwards. But that all sounds really nerdy. So
what
we mean
it.
Is, yeah. So we would normally say, like, in English, we'd say this good land that God gave us, right? And in Hebrew, you'd say something typically like, and He gave Yahweh, our God, to us, or something like that, right? That's what you would expect. But in this instance, it was Yahweh, our God, He gave to us, which, again, it doesn't sound that radical in English, but when you get used to it, especially in Deuteronomy 1 through 4, where it's reviewing history, and you get this pattern of and the parataxis, right, where you're just loading on these descriptions with and this and that and this and that. And then all of a sudden it breaks that pattern with beginning with the word, with the name of God and his title. That would cause a normal reader, someone who's conversant, more conversant than me, to pause and go, oh, wait, why did they rearrange the normal order here?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. So you might recognize some of these. From old Yoda, we get size matters not.
What?
This is funny.
Well, it's coming from Yoda.
Yeah. So
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
I'm okay. Just giving an example of
just out of context.
I'm glad you know the difference between your Bible and the
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And so I'm just we're talking about frontal elements, so it's like, well, here's some examples from Yoda. So in here we have a fronted clause, let's say. So we have always in motion is the future. So those are a couple of examples.
And he likes using his copula as well.
His what?
Lots of copula, his to be.
Oh, okay, yes. You know. Yes, that's the other one. Okay, talk about that. Yeah.
Right. Well, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but something like.
So he's got this. So actually, you kind of touched upon this when you were talking about how in the Bible we often have, we kind of have these dangling auxiliary verbs at the beginning of our sentences. Yeah. He does the same thing, but he tends to do it at the end of the sentence.
Hmm.
Have you noticed that?
Okay, what's an example of that?
I got it. Lost a planet, Master Obi-Wan has.
Wow. Oh, that is, that's very British.
Much to learn. Like, I feel... Much to learn, you still have.
Wow.
Help you, I can. And then he says yes. So we got another auxiliary on that. Help you, I can, yeah. Yes.
Okay, so...
And if you want to look at our modern poetry, that does that, and we're talking about Christmas, and this one I got off of an article, they talked about how the Little Drummer Boy does the same thing in a lot of its poetics.
For those of us that have tried to actively ignore that song, what's a line from the Little Drummer Boy?
Great.
Something, 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 something will be a rum-pa-pum-pum, right?
The one about, there's that one about the king. So it starts off, he actually does fronting in that one too.
Hold on, I'm looking it up right now. You know, Little Drummer Boy is on The Office.
It's what?
It's whose favorite song? Is it Angela's favorite song on The Office? A newborn king to see. Pa-rum-pum-pum-pum. Our finest gifts we bring. To lay before the king. I'm just reading through the lyrics of it. Yeah, you're right. I had not noticed that.
So what you get with Little Drummer Boy is the OSV, object, subject, verb order. Or you could say XSV. Some linguists would say X instead of O. The element, X is the element that modifies or goes with the verb, oftentimes an object, but not necessarily. And that is what the majority of Yoda's distinctive speech apparently is. And we get that with the Little Drummer Boy.
Okay, so this is the nerdiest conversation about the distinctives of Hebrew poetry, narrative, and Yoda and Christmas.
So now when you hear the Little Drummer Boy, it's like, you can think of Yoda, but when you think of Yoda, you can think of the Little Drummer Boy.
Come, they told. Pa-rum-pum-pum-pum. A newborn king to see. Pa-rum-pum-pum-pum. Our finest gifts we bring. Pa-rum-pum-pum-pum.
It's funny as I remember the GPSs that would tell, like when they were a little box that sat on your dashboard of your car. I never had one, but it was just a GPS device. Like a TomTom or I don't remember the other brand name.
Garmin.
And you could, Garmin, yeah.
Blast from the past.
Excuse me. And you could download different voices. You could have like Samuel L. Jackson going like, turn right here.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But there was a Yoda one. Like,
oh my gosh.
To the right you will turn. You know. And,
are you kidding me?
No.
Did
I
actually
remember,
change like the syntax?
Yeah, no. It changed the syntax.
That is brilliant. Which, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which I remember I was driving with some guy in Scotland, and he's like, oh, check this out, and he turned it on Yoda voice, and I actually found it really confusing, because when you want directions, you just want to know, right? And when you shake up that word order, you have to do a little cognitive processing to figure out exactly what they're saying.
But think about what the effect of that is, right? Exactly. Think mm-hmm. about the effect of that is on the audience.
Absolutely.
So it's that shorthand way of making it sound like something ancient and something that's 900 years old, which is what Yoda was.
Yeah, and I think it also, it's what I do love Robert Alter's, I think the phrase he uses is the foreignizing of the text, right? Mm. This is what English translations often try to do. They try to make it more familiar. And he said, no, we need to kind of be estranged from the way that they're doing things literarily so we can appreciate the distinctives.
Hmm.
By the way, since we've talked about Robert Alter and Mary Sternberg, mm-hmm. my pitch, my explaining to biblical scholars what we're doing with the Center for Hebraic Thought, my pitch is basically what Robert Alter is trying to do to help people understand the literary savvy of the biblical authors. Mm-hmm. We're trying to do for the philosophical savvy of the biblical authors.
That's a good way
to help people understand that there really is something. They do it very differently than the way we think of intellectual conversation and think reasoning through abstract ideas to concrete instances. But once you learn the way they're doing it and you come to appreciate how narrative, legal reasoning, poetry are actually very structured forms of argument, it's kind of a whole nother world opens up in the text. And also, I think for me, it's for the church. It helps you understand how this isn't just a cute story with a moral to it, like a VeggieTales, like, you know, principle that can be extracted from it. But it's actually trying to shape the way we think about the world. And it gives us the tools to think more shrewdly about the world around us. And what's been amazing to me is even topics like, I mean, we're talking about Yoda and the kind of the cultural analysis of the baby Yoda story in Mandalorian. But we're really doing it because our training as biblical scholars has fired up all these things within us that we see these trajectories, we see these emphases springing out of the biblical narrative that get us excited. There's another discussion, which we don't have time for here, which would be how they're doing the same thing in the biblical narrative with the cultural stories of their day. So the spaghetti westerns and the Christmas stories of Egypt, you know, the infant exposure motif, which I talked about in that past episode. Even the Noah story, right? They're leaning into known stories in order to draw upon those genres and type scenes in order to tell you a story about the history of Israel and of creation itself. So, well, I don't think we ever introduced you, so I'm going to have to edit this back in.
Okay.
Who are you, and what's your purpose for existing? Or at least one.
My purpose for existing is to know and glorify God.
Oh, that's so cliche.
You know, I'm okay with cliche if it's true.
Yeah, there you go.
It's true.
And who are you?
My name is Mary Catherine Yemhing Hom. I am currently in Sacramento, California. I spend most of my time with my mom. She had a very debilitating stroke over a year ago. And we have had one hell of an adventure over the past year and a half. She is the bravest, strongest person I've ever personally known, especially after I've seen what she chose to survive. She did not have to choose to make it through that, but she did. And I'm very proud of her. This season with her is, I did it initially for her, but it has changed my life in such a good way. I've been overdue, to just be in this place, and to be, communing with her and her dog and the Lord and the interesting community that's risen up around us, through such a time as this. So,
All right. Thank you, Mary, very much for this time and the energy to think up that we should talk about this as well. And I'm probably going to have to come back to you and use you more as a resource to discuss these kind of complicated situations.
Yeah. So then I can watch more Star Wars stuff.
I don't know if I want to subject anybody to more Star Wars, but I enjoy it as entertainment.
Well, and that's the thing. It's designed. It is actually narratologically structured that way to give you a nice, easy, pleasant ride. I mean, I think the first one, so to speak, the episode 4, I think it's brilliant what they did. I mean, George Lucas took a very, very classic story, a no-fail story that has just, you know, has survived like eons, literally, various cultures, languages, all that. He took it and he just gave it a super fresh, sci-fi face.
He just moved it to a galaxy far, far away.
Exactly. But that's all he
has. And
had
also
to do.
Fantastic special effects and, you know, character and costume design. Yeah.
The acting is laughable. That's part of the entertainment now. But I mean, what he did, I mean, he didn't have to get fancy on that.
Yeah.
And that's what made it a really nice ride for everybody. And we just kept on riding with him. And so again, that's going back to type scenes. You know, it's a brilliant use of type scenes, the brilliant use of different cultural allusions that the Star Wars franchise has been doing. Those are really the episodes, and for the TV series, the chapters that hit home, and the characters, like Baby Yoda, that hit home.
Yeah.
It's the ones where they make use of what's already in culture, what's already in history, what's already common to our society. If we are aware of that, I think it helps us understand more, honestly, maybe how we're being emotionally manipulated, intellectually manipulated, or influenced or encouraged to think. And is that a bad thing? Not necessarily. Let's be honest. Our pastors do it all the time. But I think as people who are encouraged, whether you're Jewish or Christian, to love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, we need to be able to think critically about these things and know what's going on, what we're taking in.
Okay, I think I just had an idea for a future podcast episode. We're going to talk about how pastors use the techniques. As a former pastor, I know them all, but I have strong feelings about using techniques to move people along in their thinking or emotions in certain ways.
So, I do too.
Okay, we'll have to end it right here.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.